Welcome back to The Monitor. Our first guest is Roy Idleson. If you missed the beginning of the show, here's what I already told you. He is a psychologist. He's an associate director of the Solomon Asch Center for the Study of Ethno-Political Conflict at Bryn Mawr College. He's past president of Psychologists for Social Responsibility. He's a member of the Coalition for an Ethical Psychology, and he's been on this show. I want to say this is your third time, Roy. Is that right?
That sounds about right. It's always nice to be with you.
That sounds right. We have a link on our website to two of your most recent articles. One is titled Bait and Switch, Psychology and Trump's Voter Fraud Tantrums, and the other is The Predatory Presidency. And those are on Psychology Today and Common Dreams, respectively. So if you want to go to our website, you can just click those and find Roy's latest pieces that we'll be discussing here. So, Roy, we had Greg Palast and a couple of other people who followed the election closely, who predicted before it happened that there would be voter suppression tactics, that, in fact, voter fraud, as it's being represented by Donald Trump, is practically non-existent, but that, in fact, voter suppression, the reduction of the number of polling places selectively by neighborhood and income level and perhaps even sometimes race, was a key deciding factor in turnout and also eventually in the result. But obviously since the election, President Trump, for my money at least, is one of the sorest winners perhaps ever. So for people who haven't had a chance to read this first article, Bait and Switch, what are you getting at? What is the psychology of President Trump's voter fraud tantrums?
Well, I think what he's doing is, in a sense, preparing for the next election, either for him or for those he would like to have in office. So if he can persuade enough of the public that there's a problem with massive illegal voting, then crackdowns of various sorts on who can vote or what you need at the polling place in order to vote suddenly seem more reasonable. And unfortunately, I think he's been reasonably successful. I think a pretty substantial, it's not a majority, but a substantial minority of Americans in recent polling have said yes, they think there is massive voter fraud. The statistics clearly say otherwise. I think it was the Brennan Center compared it to you're more likely to be struck by lightning than you are to impersonate someone else at the polls. So it's close to non-existent, but by claiming it's a big problem, it opens the door to steps that are going to keep or make it harder for people to vote, especially people who fit into certain categories.
So from a sort of analyst perspective, from a psychologist perspective, what is it? I mean, you mentioned something here called the combating injustice mind game. What is that, and what is the psychology behind the rhetoric that the president is regularly, despite no evidence to support his argument, regularly presenting about? You know, he's famously said things in Twitter and elsewhere about that he would have won the popular vote as well had it not been for, 3.5 to 5 million illegal votes.
Yes, he's been pretty consistent about that.
So what is the psychology behind this?
Well, the combating injustice mind game is one of several propaganda techniques that tend to be really effective, unfortunately, because they tap into our core concerns. And one of those core concerns involves issues of justice and injustice. We naturally want to right wrongs when they've been identified. We want people who have done wrong to be punished. We look at the world, in a sense, we wake up every day and ask ourselves, am I being treated fairly? Are the people I care about being treated fairly? That matters a lot to us. So any initiative that can be presented as one that combats injustice tends to be more persuasive than the average argument. It's kind of a soft target. We're ready to believe and embrace the idea that this is worth doing if we accept the idea that it will correct injustices. So that's what he's done in the kind of voter fraud realm. He's presented this as a terrible injustice. He's not the first. I mean, this is this goes back, you know, years and years and years, and has, I guess, been in certain ways especially prevalent in the last, or let's say this century, the last decade. The Republican Party, their platform has, in the past two election cycles, included references to, you know, the big problem and injustice of voter fraud. True the Vote, which I think is a Texas outfit, presents itself as kind of average Americans trying to keep our voting fair, and it tends to be persuasive. And the polling shows that that people think there's more voting fraud than there really is, but psychologically, we're ready to embrace those views, even when they're clearly untrue. We like the idea of people combating injustice.
So let me tread into some slightly delicate ground here. You say that people have this sort of natural propensity to seek to right a wrong. And, you know, we might disagree about this, I don't know, but it's my perception that Donald Trump and, you know, populist right-leaning politicians generally tend to appeal to a sort of nativist, almost racist streak of a voter base. And while I don't claim that that is the majority of his support, it's certainly a significant portion. I don't know what portion it would be, maybe a quarter or a third, or, you know, I haven't done the research to give you a specific number. But the sense that a wrong needs to be corrected tends to have this sort of anti-immigrant or anti-brown undertone. And it's the accusation, you know, in the Trump tweets about illegal voting tend to be directed against what he calls illegal immigrants. So he's making a doubly false claim that there are somehow millions of people voting illegally and that they're also illegally in the country. I'm not quite sure how they would do this. Mm-hmm. But so I guess my concern is this, and this is where I want your opinion, you know, as a psychologist. Do people equally have generally this sort of sense of wanting to right a wrong, and how much more dangerous can that sense be if you couple it with another sense of a wrong that's been done to you and your group, which in the case of you know, a significant group within the Republican base is people who want to make America great again, which in their minds means going back to, I mean, they haven't given me a specific decade, maybe the 50s, maybe the 40s before, you know, people of color could vote, maybe the, you know, 1900s before women could vote. They're not very specific about when America was great that they want to go back to.
Mm-hmm.
But what do you make of that? And I'm struggling to find a way to word this without, you know, offending people. But I'm trying to get your thoughts on what I understand is a delicate question.
Sure. Well, I mean, basically, I agree with your description. And part of what happens, I mean, if we want to combat injustice, I mean, people will disagree about what is just and unjust. And for example, there are going to be clearly some Americans who feel that that the system has turned against them, that people of color have are, you know, gaining ground while they are not, or while they are losing ground, and they may perceive that as an injustice in its own right. You don't, I don't, many people don't see it that way. But that does just compound the problem, or the potential damage that this can do, because when someone like Donald Trump is saying, you know, that voter fraud is a huge problem, it's an injustice, that is especially going to appeal to those who don't want certain people voting. But in a broader sense, it's going to appeal to anyone who believes that people who shouldn't be entitled to vote, you know, are. So it can draw from beyond the kind of racist, nativist categories of people and pull in people who don't hold those views but do think that, you know, people are entitled to vote if they're citizens, and they're entitled to vote but only once. And, you know, part of what makes it difficult to resist that push is that it can lead to proposals that are differentially impactful on different groups of people. So,
like the voter ID laws and that kind of stuff.
Right, yeah. which are going to hurt lower income people more. They're going to hurt students more. They're going to hurt African Americans, Hispanic Americans, and those are groups that tend not to, for example, did not vote for Trump in large numbers and don't vote for Republicans typically.
So this is a little bit outside of your specialty, but what do you make of the Democratic Party not doing a great job in explaining this? I know that's not your area, but I'm always puzzled. Over the years on this show, we've had various people on describing the voter suppression tactics, describing the reduction of polling places, forcing people to stand in line, running out of ballots, forcing them to file provisional ballots which don't get counted, and all that kind of stuff. All the games that get played, especially in states that are controlled by Republican, either attorney generals or governors or both, and the goal, and it appears to have been fairly successful in the last three presidential elections, is to suppress the vote among poorer people who also tend to be disproportionately not white. And it's had an impact at the state level, at the local level, at the federal level, and now, of course, at the presidential level. Why are the Democrats so quiet about this?
Well, that's a great question. I don't know the answer to that. It bothers me. It seems like this is a crucial issue. It shouldn't have gone unaddressed, or there should have been more outrage about it. Sometimes I wonder if there's the idea that perhaps common ground can be found, or, you know, not making waves. It's not working. We can see that, in the political sphere, and not there alone, there can be a ruthlessness, you know, to impose one's agenda. And if you don't accept or recognize just how ruthless that can be, you're not necessarily ready to defend against it. I do agree, again, with you that not enough has been done to kind of argue the other side. And, of course, the ideal time to do that is before the election,
right?
Not after, although there's always another election.
Yeah, I mean, my sense, I guess, to some extent, is that the Democrats as a party do all kinds of dirty tricks themselves, and so maybe they don't want to call too much attention to the dirty tricks that the Republicans are playing for fear that the whole thing gets, you know, out in the open, and then people will dislike both parties more than they already do, and people tend to dislike both parties quite a bit already.
Mm-hmm.
I want to jump into your other article, The Predatory Presidency, because it's connected to that delicate question that I was trying to ask. You point out in this article that there are three specific executive orders from the White House that are problematic, that also tend to predominantly target non-white communities. What are those three executive orders, and why do you find a problem with them?
Well, the three I refer to, and it's probably the case that pretty much every executive order we've seen so far has serious problems, but there's the three I am most interested in at the moment are the Muslim travel ban, which, you know, clearly targets Muslims and is keeping foremost Muslim refugees from war-torn places, among others, like Syria, out of the country. That's one of them. The second one is the executive order that now involves essentially stalking and raiding and going after undocumented Hispanic immigrants almost wherever they may be, and regardless of how law-abiding they may have been since entering the country, and rounding them up, detaining them, deporting them. And the third one is this blueprint for a kind of a tough-on-crime, which is a dog whistle to many, law enforcement crackdown. And if we kind of toughen law enforcement in the way that is suggestive here, if we increase if we increase what they are free to do in the pursuit of supposedly protecting us, we can be sure that that's going to primarily disrupt and besiege the black community.
So these police measures, I'm sure they involve things like, you know, jailing Wall Street people who forced the stock market to crash.
You must have looked at it more carefully than I did.
Here's my question for you. This is what I consider to be certainly a question for a psychologist. The Muslim travel ban, it sort of falls into that voter fraud, propaganda game of playing to people's fears and making it seem like the thing you're proposing is reasonable if the people you're proposing it to don't know enough about the subject. These are just my words, so you can definitely disagree with everything that I'm saying. If it's really a Muslim ban, and certainly Rudy Giuliani and Donald Trump, through various statements, have expressed their desire to make it so, that it should be a Muslim ban. But it's a very selective ban, right? The list of countries doesn't include, if we're being sold this idea that we have to keep these people out of the country because, they're a danger to national security, they're, potential terrorist infiltrators, et cetera, that's the way it's being sold, to play to people's fears, especially, in the wake of various incidents around the country. It seems odd to me, the biggest terrorist incident being 9/11, that Saudi Arabia is not on that list, or that Egypt is not on that list. 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudis, and yet we've got countries where there is no history whatsoever of any of their citizens doing anything in this country to harm others in the name of their religion or their geography or their race, from some of the countries that are being banned, Syria, Yemen, etc. So how is it that the administration is able to get away with what seems to be equally a dog whistle of, banning Muslims, but not actually banning Muslims really at all, just selectively banning certain kinds of people?
Well, I think they're starting with or trying to start with a ban that would be easiest to impose, in that it doesn't go against some of the most powerful, predominantly Muslim countries. Where the United States has long tried to have a kind of positive, collaborative relationship, even when there are dictators involved, so Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and so on. But there's also a very familiar psychological technique, and I'm not saying that is playing out here, but who knows. Is the foot in the door technique, which is basically, if you want to sell something, if you can start, if you can make a small sale, it's then easier to come back and make another sale or to make a larger sale. So, I wouldn't rule out the possibility that you start with seven countries and then that gets expanded, although I don't think, Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I don't see Saudi Arabia being on that list, maybe ever.
Yeah,
which makes me take the whole notion of it being a Muslim ban with a very large mountain of salt. It seems odd that, again, the media and the Democrats and the opponents of this administration are not pointing this out very, very loudly. And I don't really understand what to make of that, because it should be something that anyone should be able to, laugh at. This is not a Muslim ban. Are you crazy? Why is Saudi not on the list?
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, Mark. I think it can be a Muslim ban but it doesn't include everyone. I mean, basically, but it's a Muslim ban in the sense that most of the people who will be kept out of the country are Muslim.
Yeah, no, I get that. I mean, here's my take on it, and you know, this be my last question. I'll leave the final word to you. My sense is that it's a ban on Muslims who might want to actually come here, to emigrate, to move, to seek asylum. There aren't a lot of those from Saudi, and so you're not trying to keep Muslims from visiting the country. You're trying to keep Muslims from moving to the country. So that's why, you know, typically more affluent Saudi is not banned from traveling to the U.S., where a Syrian refugee is banned from traveling to the U.S. We don't want them coming here to stay.
I am persuaded by that logic.
Well, that was easier than I expected. Okay, well, I think our second guest is on hold already, but I want to leave the last word to you as a psychologist. What do you make of the current situation that we're in? I mean, it seems to me like a very strange universe. It's a kind of a weird unraveling. What's your professional take?
Well, I agree. Some really challenging and awful things are unfolding, and it's exciting to see the extent of resistance that has to continue, has to persist. But part of what's going to be difficult for us is that there are these mind games, and Trump seems very good at using them, where we are easily or too easily fooled into thinking that what is being done is reasonable or is being done for a particular purpose, when in fact it's neither reasonable nor being done for the reasons that are claimed. And that there's a different agenda and an ugly agenda that goes unnoticed or not sufficiently noticed. So I think it's just going to be a challenging time ahead. That is far from profound. But
yeah. No, I mean, exciting in the sense of a train wreck, I suppose.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. Okay, well, I definitely appreciate your time, and I'll continue to follow the stuff that you write. You know, keep me on your email list, and I'll get you back on in the future.
Great. Thanks very much, Mark.